Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here today and to introduce and facilitate this in conversation with James Barner, important, significant, pioneering artist and very good friend, whose work really now, in many ways, I was having a conversation yesterday with Mark Seely, our director in the office at Autograph at Rivington Place, and we were saying how now the history of African photography and photography in general, but African photography specifically, cannot really be talked about without James Barner's work being written into it. So we're very proud to have achieved that together over the last few years. So my name is Renee Musai. I'm based in London, where I've worked with Autograph ABP for the last 10 years, over a decade, primarily on curating and managing our archive and research center at Rivington Place. First, I'd like to just say a few thank yous and acknowledgements. This exhibition really would have not been possible without the support of the Heritage Lottery Fund and, of course, the core funding by the Arts Council. And most importantly, a group of individuals who've given their time, expertise, and dedication to making it happen over the last few years. Autograph's director, Mark Seely, and Autograph staff such as Zoe Maxwell, Sinead Samuel, Emma Boyd, Brandon Wettenberg, all people who've left the organization by now, but who've been absolutely instrumental and crucial in working with James Archive. And of course, I want to acknowledge and extend my gratitude to James himself for his trust and faith in working with me and with Autograph in preserving his work and making it accessible to a wider public. So on behalf of Autograph and Mark Seely, a big thank you to everyone who's been part of this process, and especially also the galleries and institutions who've helped to keep it in the public realm over the last few years. So a big thank you to Anne and Pippa and everybody else at Impressions Gallery for their tremendous support and hosting of this exhibition. So for those of you who are not familiar with Autograph, just a few words. We are an international photographic arts charity based in London at Rivington Place, established in 1988 with the mission to promote different photographic practices that address issues around human rights, race, representation, cultural identity, and to nurture and disseminate the work by artists from diverse cultural backgrounds who've been historically positioned at the periphery of the international art discourse, often marginalized within sub-histories of so-called otherness. We do this through publications, exhibitions, commissions, educational interventions, and we work internationally. And to redress this imbalance and highlight the many untold histories and missing chapters, if you like, inherent in contemporary and historical debates around photography and representation, we have spent the last 7 years establishing this archive and research center, which was really trying to address and remedy this gap within the visual representation of Britain's cultural, wider cultural history and the diverse communities. And as such, critically explores global politics around migration, diaspora, and difference through photography. So before we begin this in conversation, just a couple of words about the background of the exhibition as such. So for me, this exhibition really represents a labor of love and dedication. It was the most successful show that we've held at Rivington Place since we opened in 2007, in terms of audience numbers, but also in terms of the diversity of audiences, intergenerational and from different backgrounds that it attracted. A lot of that was due to James' presence in the exhibition. I would say that you spent probably at least 2 days a week being at Rivington Place and interacting and engaging with people, just sharing his stories. And one of the most amazing elements of curating this show over the years really has been the privilege and pleasure of being in James's presence and having his voice there to contextualize the images and animate them with the stories, with the names. So often, especially when we show studio portraiture and from Africa and different geographical spaces in particular, we don't have names. We don't have the names of the people. We don't know who they were, where they came from, what they did. And to have James's incredible memory and his time and passion and dedication to representing these different cultures and people and giving those faces names has been pretty amazing, I must say. So, briefly again, about 6 years ago in 2007, we received a substantial grant from the Heritage Lottery fund to invest organizational resources to establishing this archive I mentioned earlier, reflecting Britain's multicultural history through photographic imagery, and more than anything else, making it accessible to a wider public through a permanent collection. So in many ways, what we also try to do is to build a resource and a set of portfolios and resources in terms of education packs, in terms of publications and newspapers that people can access at any point during the year, to move away from a kind of Black History Month ideology where only 30 days out of the year these images become visible on public display. So it was very much about the permanent investment in the work and preserving it. So the initial plan at that point was to, one, look at our existing collection of works, which was mostly built upon 20 years of commissioning new artist work, but then on the other hand also to enhance this collection with the addition of newly curated photographs that resonate the remit and collection focus, and which are not accessible in any other public institutions. So over a period of 4 years, we were meant to work with 21 new individual artists to enhance our collection. And building comprehensive portfolios of each of their work over, let's say, maybe 1 or 2 months spent with each of those artists. But then fate intervened, and what happened is that right in the middle of this process, in spring 2009, I think, I was introduced to James Barner by a colleague called Nana Ofoyeta Ayim, and which meant that instead of making progress with the collection on the whole, we ended up spending about 18 months virtually exclusively on the preservation of Mr. Barner's archive. And the fruits of this exercise and investment are visible on the gallery walls here today. So during this period, every time James came to the office, he was laughing because on every, there was, on the one hand, there was a white-gloved archivist in the midst of hundreds, thousands, probably 10,000 of negatives, all having James's name written on them, and transferring them from Tupperware food boxes and Tesco bags and little sleeves and books into archival acid-free sleeves. And every computer screen in the archive was filled with James's photographs being digitally preserved and retouched in an attempt to try and get them back to their original state, whilst other colleagues were on the phone, on press. So basically Operation Barner had taken autographs offices for the time being. So in many ways, this exhibition was the first show that was curated out of this growing, emerging archive. And it came out of a very long and rigorous process of research and cataloging and digital preservation and contextualizing. So as I said earlier, the exhibition represents a well-deserved and long-overdue showcase, the first gallery museum showcase for this pioneering photographer, but also for autograph. It was very much about looking at the photographic archive in relation to visual politics of race, representation, and difference, and what happens when we kind of rediscover and decontextualize images that were taken in many ways 60, 50 years ago for a very different purpose, and then reanimate them in a gallery setting. But we were also looking at questions around modernity and visibility within a post-colonial, transatlantic, and diasporic discourse on photography. So the journey of the exhibition has been incredible over the last 3 years. It started as a small showcase at Harvard University at their W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research. This was 2010, I think early 2010, right before its full manifestation at Rivington Place in the autumn of 2010, and then coming full circle on the African continent over 2 rooms at the National Portrait Gallery in Cape Town, 2011 and 12, and now returning to the UK here at Impressions Gallery. In between, the Tate Britain has shown the work as part of their summer blockbuster photography show called Another London. Yes, last summer. So that was another amazing moment, seeing James's work at the Tate Britain, next to photographs by Henri Cartier-Bresson, etc. So We were very proud to have achieved that. And then spaces like the V&A or the Government Art Collection, the Tate, have acquired the work, and now they're, you know, permanently preserved as part of a national treasure, which is what they should be. And just last weekend, and that's the last thing I'm going to say before I pass over the mic to you, last weekend, two of the portraits in the show here, the Lady in Pink from 1966, and one of my favorite images in the show, Marie Halowy, were shown at Covent Garden Underground Station on a massive screen as part of the Africa Center Summer Festival. So thousands of commuters would have had the opportunity to see the show. And I think another portrait, Erlin Eybrek at the back, a drum commission, is currently on its way to France from Germany. So they are traveling. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming James Barner.
Hello, everybody. I'll ask permission to be a little bit informal.
Yes, permission.
Thank you. One of my specialties in photography is group photography, photographing large groups, and also babies or children. And when I'm photographing groups, I like to see everybody's face because I need to sell the pictures afterwards. Anybody who hides behind, you know, a head and thinks that because his eyes are seeing me and so the whole body is making a mistake. So I don't see all of you and I don't think all of you see me. So I'll ask permission to go up a bit, you know, so that perhaps I can either stand or sit by the side of the table so that I can see everybody. Isn't that a change? Because I would like to.
I don't think it's stable enough.
Are you sure? I'm not very heavy.
All right. Maybe sit this side then.
Sit. Anyway. Let me start by thanking Rennie for introducing me. The thing I say is that when you get a friend or you marry or you get association over a period and it's so good, you forget about how you met. So now I'm forgetting about how I met Rennie or I got in touch with Autograph. But now I can confess that I can't live without Autograph, as you can see. So we are now one. We work together, and the work is outside. I want us to be as informal as possible so that by the end of the talk or the party, we are all friends, you know. And because I understand there are some people who feel shy to ask questions. You know, that should vanish. If you want to ask any question at the end of the talk, you can ask questions so that we all understand why we are here and we know one another.
Can I interrupt you? I'm sorry, you will forgive me. Can you tell everybody a little bit about the early days? You were born 1929 in Accra. Do you want to tell a little bit what it was like?
Yes, I always like to play on that I am old, 1929, you know, and I say, you know, because I'm older than most people that come to see my work, I can afford to tell lies, because they have no way of checking, you know. Say, if I said that there was somebody called Cecil King, and he was the director or the chief of the Dillon Mirror Group, you may not know him unless you go on research. Now, this man came to Ghana to buy a paper before independence, sensing what Ghana would be. When they get independence, he thought he would introduce the newspaper in Ghana. So they came to Ghana and bought a paper. And I met this man, you know, and he was instrumental in me becoming a newspaper photographer. If you are able to check and find that this is untrue, then I'll give you a signed picture. These are the sort of lies that I put through, you know, that the entourage, the people with whom he came to Ghana, there was a photographer, an old man called McLellan. He was a mirror photographer, and he was the one who came to check about the quality of the photographer or how they are going to establish a photographic department and train one. And this man went to my master. I trained as a portrait photographer in a studio where you have a camera with a big tripod and a black cloth and a plate. When you focus the object, it turns upside down, you know, in contrast to what today you have a mobile and you can take a picture anyway, you know. And I learned for 2 years. I served as an apprentice for 2 years.
46, 47?
47 to 49, from 47. Mm-hmm. Before then, I was a pupil teacher, an untrained teacher, but I worked as if I was trained. Because I knew how to weave baskets, and that was what got me into the school. They wanted me more than I wanted the school. And I also took charge of the school band. All our colonial schools had bands, you know, so early in the morning we played the band and marched and did all sorts of things, and I was in charge. Because when I was at school, I was a flautist, and I was in the band. And I did basket weaving, as well as a little bit of drawing, plus the band, and some music. I did that for 2 years, and then I went to do the apprenticeship. I'm talking about the apprenticeship because I was strictly tied down to studio photography, retouching. You know, that's somewhere we will talk about how I got the Ever Young.
I think you should tell them. You should tell them the story now. Yes.
The idea. What I learned, you know, as a retoucher, you spend about an hour, 30 minutes, 1 hour on one head, one face, especially if the portrait is a big one, filling the spaces, you know, and doing some partings and so on, which is not done today. What is done today has been taken over by Photoshop. You know, it's okay, but it's different. And I was actually disciplined to do that sort of thing. So when I finished and started doing, I thought, what should the name of my studio be? And I remembered that when we were at school, we did a comprehensive extract where the teacher will give you an extract, either read it or give you a page in a book to read, and then for some few minutes then bring the questions on the board. And the story went like this. Iduna, the beautiful young goddess of the Norsemen, lived in a pretty grove called Ever Young. She had a golden casket full of the most wonderful apples. A hero might come, tired and weary, to Iduna's grove, feeling that he was growing old. Then Iduna would give him an apple, and as soon as he had eaten it, he would feel fresh and young again. That's where the Ever Young, the magical changing of the figure, you know, from old to young comes in. Now, it was not surprising that Iduna's grove was never lonely. And what was still more wonderful was that her supply of apples never failed. as soon as the last rosy fruit was given away, the casket was filled again by an invisible hand. This was the extract. And then after you read it, then you get the questions, you know, to find out how much you understood it or how much you remember. That was it. I didn't think that I would need this extract at all in my life. You know. But when I learned photography and this retouching business came to be the principle of your studio portraiture, then I thought, wow. So I remembered it. And so I went to my teacher. I'll show you the portrait of my teacher somewhere. That's him. He was my top class teacher. And I said, do you remember that when we were in school, we did something like that? He said, yes. He went into his room, brought a Nelson's English reader, one of these colonial textbooks, and he said, look at it. And he started reading it. He said, go and study it and bring it back. So I took it and copied it, and so I sort of went through it. That made me, believe that I'm on the right line. So I picked Ever Young. There were so many questions, because I think one of the questions that was asked in the extract was, give this story another name or your own name. And there was either Idunes Grove or Ever Young, and I took Ever Young. But Idunes Grove is now my Skype name.
James, with Ever Young, Ever Young as a name existed before the physical studio was there in Jamestown. I think you operated under Ever Young,
even
when you took some of the photographs outside in a makeshift studio. We've got some of those early vintage prints there, and then Ever Young.
Ever Young was the name that
So from 1949, yeah. So from 1949, and then from 1953, you had the actual studio.
Yes, I had the actual studio.
Can you talk a little bit about where it was situated in Accra, which at the time
Jamestown.
Was called the Gold Coast, was
yes.
still under colonial rule.
Yes.
So perhaps can you speak a little bit about the context of Ever Young, also maybe the, you know, what was happening at the time as the society was transitioning towards independence?
I feel a bit emotional or nostalgic when we talk about that, because someone in America whom I hadn't met, who'd seen my work and talked about it or written about it, suggested, has it ever occurred to you that you go back to Accra or Ghana and reestablish your studio again? You know, and I said, it is possible I'll get another place. He said, no, the same place. So that, your question brings back to the effect of what the studio had in the community, the location. It was different. You know, when I say it had a big effect, there was a hotel, a nightclub next to it. So the studio, the effect of the nightclub in the area, the lighthouse, which led to the harbor, and also a chief's palace just opposite, made everything work very well. And I wish I could do it. I wish I could do it, because that place is changed now. It's more or less degenerated. I just returned from Ghana. And even the building itself, recently somebody took a picture of it as it is today, compared to what it was in 1953.
What was it like in 1953?
1953, it was the pivot. It was the corner. In fact, the road too was an important road in Jamestown, along the high street, turns off from the high street into St. Edmund Street and left to the harbor. And it was where anybody who came to Ghana, Gokos, landed. Mm-hmm. Apart from Takradi or Sekendi, if you came by boat, you landed in. So, and all the goods passed through that harbor. The cocoa went through there, and the flour, and all the things that came to Ghana. In fact, I witnessed what it was like before we had independence, you know, as a child and also as a photographer working. So sometimes I don't want to think of it too much, because if I can get some funding, we will do what I did in a better way this time, so that younger people will learn, will have something to do, and there will be more allied subjects to photography, not just taking pictures, but we can have other things, boat building, carpenters, and change the whole place, and give jobs and the future to young people.
And James, at the time, so you, not only did you photograph, you know, friends and family and various people in new professions coming to the studio, but there were also some pretty important dignitaries, such as Kwame Nkrumah, for example. There's some very intimate photographs of you with the future leader of Ghana, I think in his own house, and some of those were commissioned for Drum magazine in the early 1950s. Drum magazine, if, for those of you who don't know, came out of South Africa, 1951-52, anti-apartheid political lifestyle politics magazine, and James worked for them in the early days in Ghana and then also later in London. Can you maybe talk a little bit about, there's a lovely anecdote that you share, I think, in the video, when you photographed Nkrumah.
I was the first newspaper photographer in Ghana, by chance or by luck or whatever it is. The Drum wanted a photographer. They went to so-called or supposed to be the best photographer in Accra. And he said, oh, I don't do this type of running around with a small camera, but I know somebody who does. And so McLellan, the old photographer, was led to my place. He came and saw my work. No, he came and talked to me, and he said, have you got anything I can see? And I brought him a small postcard, you know, which he looked through and said, not quite, but we'll train you. I haven't forgotten that. Not quite, but we'll train you. That was in 1950. And he asked me to come to see him in the press. And so I was the first to start newspaper. Before then, there was no paper printing by rotary method. All the presses were letter press, and they didn't have the need for daily news photographs. They had their blocks made by the government press, or, you know, it took some time, and they had stock photographs. But with the daily graphic printing, introducing rotary printing, you know, big machine from here to there, printing in the same roll, for the first time, they needed a regular photographer. And that was where I came in. So I was the first. And I was taking on, I think, 2 months before the paper actually started.
And the paper, the Daily Graphic?
Yes, the Daily Graphic, which was owned by the Daily Mirror. Mm-hmm. Colindale Library in London, in Colindale, they have copies from 1952. I've been to see some of my old pictures that I took when I was 23 years. So I had that experience while I still maintained my studio. So when Drum was established in South Africa, went to East Africa, and then to Nigeria, and was brought to Ghana, the proprietor once came to see how his business was running, and he was brought to me, introduced to me. I lived next to the hotel where he stayed, and he was introduced to me. And we became friends then. He was Jim Bailey, and I called myself Jim Barnard. So we had, and then we had a PRO for the government called Jim Muggsy, who handled the whole, for the first time, handled the independence celebration of Ghana, you know, from beginning to end. The PRO, you know, on the face of it, he only organized the press. But the press was, that was the first time that the world press descended on Africa or on Ghana. And he handled all that. And he was my friend. The information services was not very far from my studio. So sometimes he used to come and sit there. Once I said, I would like to come and work in your office, you know, in your department. He said, look, you've got this and you don't like it. You want to go and work for somebody else? I remember this very well. So the three of us, Jim Bailey, Jim Muggsin, and Jim Barno, were sort of close friends.
And Jim Bailey also was instrumental in many ways of you coming to London.
Jim Bailey has a picture.
It's over there.
Here.
It's in the back there.
All right.
At a beach party. I think you've shown me, they're not in the exhibition here, but there's some letters of Jim Bailey encouraging you to come to London. So because I'm aware we don't have much time, I just want to make sure.
We don't have time for my story. So
we have time for some of them.
So
but what I'm trying, James, what I'm trying to do is to get you to London, because that's a really important part. So
no, when I said I wanted to come to London, he said, you know, it's here I want you, not in London. So stay here. It was an ambition to come to London that made me say, I want to go to London. And somebody said, what for? I said, to be a press man, you know, to learn to be a press photographer. I said, oh, the graphics are coming here. And that was what stopped me from coming. But later, I think I kept it. And my teacher, I asked him, I said, you know, it's all right. And then I told Jim Bailey, he said, it's here I want you, not in London. But when he found that I had already progressed or made some arrangements, he gave up and got in touch with his sister in Peterborough. He said, all right, if he is able to come and he doesn't get a job in London, I can take care of him. But Jim Bailey advised me and said, London is the place. So if you can find a job there, the better. Peterborough is so many miles away. But that's Jim Bailey and me. It's more like a friend than employee, you know. And when I came to his office in Fleet Street, was my house or my office.
Amazing.
And we did a lot. And when it comes to black photographers in the 60s, you know, or so on, it wasn't easy. You wouldn't even get a job in a studio, having done 10 years of my own. You come to London and you are going to be a photographer in a studio and photograph white people. It didn't work. If you got a job there, you will be in the dark room. Mm-hmm. You know, the photographer will meet the public and take the pictures, and you will do the developing and printing. But it was through Drum that I got these assignments, which exposed me to the public or to models and so on. Without Drum, that connection, I don't think I would have got the slightest chance. I got a chance of some sort, but that was in the best or the leading color laboratory in Britain at the time. It was in Kent, called CPL, Color Processing Laboratory. And I got in there.
But before that, James, when you came to the UK, you came to study. So perhaps you can talk about Medway College of Art as well.
No, I didn't really come to study. I was ready to do anything and learn anything.
Okay.
And before I went to Medway College of Art, I met somebody who was preparing to go to Nigeria in 1960 to cover the independence. This person was in an elite class or elite department at Kodak Company in Kingsway. Kodak had a lecture service where the best photographers went out to talk to groups and schools and so on their specialized work. But their photography was very good, high, and also they knew what they were talking about. And Kodak employed them. And one of them was Dennis Kemp. He has a nephew at Derby University, also teaching photography today. I wished he was here, because we haven't met for some time. Dennis Kemp was going to the information service, the Ghana information, to borrow films to do his own work so that he knows, you know, what he was going to do or how to deal with black people or Africans when he goes to, and he was borrowing films there. And the information officer there knew me already and said, oh, I have somebody from Ghana who's come and he wants a job or this or that. He said, oh, I haven't got a job, but let him come and see me. And we met. So I started helping him to arrange coffee evenings and inviting black people, students and everything. And then we were doing discussions and so on for him to prepare. Before long, he changed his mind that he would go with me. Kodak was responsible for him, his hotel and everything. But at the end of it, he thought, no, I better take this man along. And so he took me. While we were there, I said, no, shall we go to Ghana? Before the ceremonies finished, I said, shall we go to Ghana? And I managed to sell the idea. He said, all right. So I left him and went to Ghana. And I said, gosh, what shall I do? I had to prepare something. I went to the Cocoa Research Institute to see if I can arrange a visit for him when he comes from Lagos so that he can see how cocoa is grown and cultivated scientifically. And when I went there, my own uncle was the PRO. So it was easy. And he came. And we did it.
James.
And from there, I took him to my own farm, my own cocoa farm, so that he could see how it's done traditionally, you know, not the scientific way. And he stayed there. We stayed there for about 4 days. And he said, you know, you left all this and came to England. Are you mad? You know, because within a radius of 100 yards or so, you can get all the fruits you wanted, anything at all. You know, we were, apart from the cocoa, edible, you know, all of it. But that was, and then from there, I arranged also, before he came, The gold mine. I had already covered a story. I've taken pictures there, and they knew me, and they knew my work. So I went there, I said, I've gone to England, I've got a friend, and he wants to see what. So that also was added to it. And we went through all the process of mining, you know, 11,000 feet down, and you know, all the chemicals, all the processes. So he had photographs of the research station, the information there. He had the life of how farmers worked, you know, and lived in their own environment when we were walking from the train to the farm, he didn't expect, he thought we would be living on trees. You know, and when he arrived there, he said, "What?" I said, "Yes." That's why he asked me whether I left all this and came.
James?
James Barnard.
James, I'm going to take you back to London because we have literally 3 minutes before we're going
to
open it to the floor for questions.
We've got to leave Ghana before we
come to London. I'm going to just take you straight back. So, we're in London. We're not in Ghana, so we're in London.
Right.
It's one thing that I, when I was first opening all of your different pouches and sleeves of photographs, I was amazed that a lot of these covers for Drum magazine were actually shot here in London. And I don't know, you were talking briefly about professional black photographers in London, but apart from the hardships and the few who did exist, the key thing is that I don't know of any other African studio photographer who actually left the continent and then photographed in the UK here. I think that's pretty incredible. And I just briefly wanted to, have you speak about the experience of learning color photography here. So you shot the Drum covers in color. It was the first time that you photographed in color. You learned it at CPL and I guess maybe at Medway College as well. And then what happened after? What did you do with this knowledge? And how were you headhunted to then change the face of photography in West Africa when you went back?
I wasn't able to achieve my aim and the promise. Because this question brings me back to when I was at the Medway College of Art where I studied. I got a scholarship, Cocoa Marketing Board scholarship from Ghana to study with this Dennis Kemp, but he said, go to school. But then I was already at the color processing laboratory, and it was at the laboratory that I got the address of Medway College of Art and went to the... While I was there, maybe two things happened. They introduced color, and they thought, you know, you are the best person to man it. So before I finished, I was given the job of a technical assistant. That's one thing. But again, the principal, the headmaster or principal, was a member of the Rotary Club. I'm coming to your question. And he introduced me to the club, and they organized something. And they asked me to organize foreign students, you know, male and female, and from various countries or various disciplines, you know, including me. And they organized something, and we had a dinner, and we had a meeting like that. And we were asked various questions. My question was, you are learning photography at the Medway College of Art in Rochester. When you finish your course, how do you intend to use it in your country? Because, you know, when you finish, you have to go to your country. You know, so how do you intend to do it? And, but they reminded me, you know, James, you don't have to talk all day. You know, it's got to be brief because others have to talk too. You know, and what I said was, I would like to go back and portray Africa or my country through the eyes of a black man, not a European who comes to on holiday for 2 or 3 days and then goes back to write a big book about, you know, Ghana or so. I would like to do it from my angle. And unfortunately, when I returned and went to Ghana, I couldn't get the chance. Through ACFAGAVAT or through the color processing, I got a job to go and start processing color in Ghana. There was no color processing either in Nigeria or Ghana. All films, color films, were sent overseas. But ACFA thought that if they could get a processing unit, then they could export more color. Because in the 60s and 70s, that was the coming thing. So if they could get, and through my contact with Ghana and also my contact with the color processing laboratory, everything worked. And they employed me. I went to Germany and Belgium and did some course, plus what I knew before, and went to Ghana to establish the first color laboratory. So I feel not big-headed, but I feel proud to be the first press photographer in Ghana, as well as the first color processor. You know, and I taught some people, but I was a salesman, come technical advisor, and so on. So I couldn't sit on one thing. I was selling X-ray materials, or selling litho films, you know, doing everything.
I think that deserves applause.
So we'll talk about the pictures. We'll talk about the pictures.
So
be careful what you ask, because when you ask too many questions, it means the James Bano book cannot be sold. Thank you very much.
So we've got about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I think we might have to use one of these. So there's about 10 minutes to ask questions to James, and then after the conversation can continue, of course.
Two questions. Is it on?
Yeah.
Firstly, why the leap from being an untrained teacher to being a photographic apprentice? How did you make that leap from teaching into wanting to become a photographic apprentice?
I think that I loved teaching. That is, you know, no doubt about it. I loved teaching. But somehow, I wished I could be a trained teacher and not just untrained teacher, because the teachers were getting the money and I was getting £25 a year. That's £2.08 when you work it out. £2.08 a month. But maybe at that time, for somebody who is not married, he hasn't got anything, £2 was okay, you know. But I thought that I could go for it. That's one. Luckily, there was an advertisement for training, special art and craft teachers training. Opportunity came, and I applied, and I didn't get it. And I said, oh, art and craft is the same as photography. And so I would like to do photography. That's one point. But I had photography in my family all over. The two people who taught me, you know, the one I said was my master.
Joy.
Who taught me, not Joy, Joy was my teacher.
Right.
That was before I went to this thing. But in my family, I had Mr. J.P.D. Dodu, who was my cousin, but he was doing photography when I was a little boy.
So you grew up with it, really?
Yeah, but I didn't work, but it was in my family. And later, when I was learning as an apprentice, by chance, I got to know of somebody else called Akins, Julius Akins. Somebody said, are you doing photography? And I said, yes. Oh, I know somebody who is good. And he told me his name and where he works. And I met him in the street by chance. And I said, are you Mr. Akins? He said, what's the matter? You know, straight away, what's the matter? And I cooled him down and I talked to him. He said, all right, this is my house. Come and see me. And that is where my life or field or attitude and understanding of photography changed, because he started me in another way. And that was where the journalistic side and the using of miniature camera, raw film camera, and so on came in.
So that leads quite nicely into my second question, really, and I'll try and keep it brief. What sort of equipment did you use to take many of your earlier images? I mean, obviously, you were shooting
we
on film.
We started with a big camera, plate camera. I'd wanted to get one plate camera to demonstrate here, to show how when you focus an image, it turns upside down. The head goes, and that's how I started. You know, so it was a full plate. Even if you're taking a passport picture, you use the full plate and put in an adapter and put in, you know, a plate the size that you wanted. Mm. So you made contact prints instead of enlarging. You see, and again, through the old people, I learned how to enlarge, make an enlargement using daylight. You know, no big enlargers. You use the same camera that you use to take your group photograph. When you finish the negative, you put the negative back in the slide and put it on the wall. Project it in the dark room onto and do your printing. Something that even photographic teachers don't know. This is something that I would like to experiment or demonstrate how to make prints, you know, with daylight, using your camera, the same camera, the same lens that you use in taking. Of course, you may have different lenses because of the length of the your room, or how far you can focus your image, you know. But you have an easel on which you focus the thing, and then put the paper on it and expose it. See, but this is interesting. Not really pinhole, because you use a lens. And you use the light from outside, and you fix the camera onto an opening. And there should be something holding the camera steady against the window. And then you can get, when I was at the color processing laboratory, there was something similar, but not daylight. They had a rail. The enlarger was on a rail. And the shots that were taken on the moon landing, the first moon landing was in 69, or all the shots were brought to Edinburgh. And we made internegative and made prints, enlargements for world exhibition. So the same type of enlarging was what was used, but not daylight. But then I knew the daylight, but I wasn't working on it. I was working on something special at the time, which it was a small job, but because it brought in money to the company, I had to teach somebody before I left. Somebody had to leave his work, come and work with me for about a month to know how to do it before I left. So as for old things, we've got it, and now we've got digital as well. So
do we have any more questions for James?
Hello, thank you, James. My question is, in Ghana, when you introduced colour into Ghana,
yes,
then did you yourself stop taking black and white in preference to colour? And did an appreciation of the black and white image come back to Ghana after the colour craze of the 60s and 70s?
The black and white was there, but the colour idea became a novelty. You know, so everybody started taking colour. And the idea of the company, or ACFA, was to not necessarily to let the company do the color processing and printing, to teach so that there will be entrepreneurs and there are photographers and businessman, you know, investing in color processing so that the whole thing will, you know, spring out. And it did, somehow. You know, when even the basic manual equipment with which we started, like one or two automatic printers and then an enlarger to make enlargements of it, it changed, and people started getting automatic cameras and automatic darkroom equipment and then processing. The black and white, people sort of tend to color. And I had to take, even though I didn't take photographs, I had to take photographs to show how the colors came in, you know, and for people and other photographers to copy. So we did carry on the color. But I would have liked to do more, but I couldn't. And at that time, Ghana, because of economic, was a seller's market. So the seller didn't have to advertise too much to get the people to buy from them. But I would have liked to have got a place where I could demonstrate how to use the equipment that we were selling and how to use the materials, especially controlling your light, controlling your exposure. That was something that we had difficulty with. You know, we've got all the light, mm-hmm. and we've got all the film, you know, and there was no photographic training school to tell you how to use an exposure meter and how to even light your and control so that when you develop, you have time and temperature. You know, the first time I heard about time and temperature was when McLellan took me to his hotel, because he didn't have much time. You know, he had, you know, they came to get the press going and he had to return. But I visited him once or twice in his hotel. And then I learned to load a roll film onto a tank, a spiral tank, and then, you know, use a temperature, a thermometer to, that was the first time. Nobody knew about it. Nobody knew about it. And these are things that when I went back, I thought I could introduce. But, you know, with a seller's market, you don't get the money to do the establishment and the space and get people to come and see how to light an object or a subject, or when you are developing, how you control your time and temperature to control your negative so that printing can be easy. But then we had grade 1, 2, 3, 4 to 10 or whatever. So when your negative is overexposed, you still have a paper to print it. See, so...
James,
I couldn't
sorry.
Do most of the things that I would have liked to have done when I went back. Like, say, you know, when I go to Ghana, I'll take pictures to show how a Ghanaian sees Ghana. I didn't get it, but all the same.
Yeah, so I'm going to bring you back to Bradford now. Thank you. Just want to say, so as I said, just immediately now, it's their summer party. We also have a summer sale on in the bookshop, 10, 20 and up to 50% off. And we also have 5 copies of this book in the bookshop, which isn't in the sale, but it's still a bargainistic price at $16.99. And I'm sure if you buy one, you could ask James to sign it for us. So I just want to say thank you so much to Renee for curating the show, for your introduction about Autograph. Thank you so much to Mr. Barner here. It's been a really lovely treat having him up in Bradford for the past 2 days. Pippa and I are both exhausted, but we wouldn't have swapped it for the world. So thank you for doing the portfolio reviews with students yesterday, and thank you for your exhibition, and thank you for your talk today. Thank you, and thank you, Autograph.
I must say that Young and the story behind Ever Young, I am impressed to be here at Impressions. I must say, I'm highly impressed. It's a catalog. It's a catalog of photographs, exhibition made last year. It ran at the same time as the Olympics. You know, last year it was opened the same day as the Olympics, and it contains about 180 photographs of what they describe as international photographers who passed through London from 1930 to 1980. And a collector bought them from Autograph, yes, and donated them to the Tate, and they were exhibited. And somehow, I had four pictures in the exhibition. And I think that is the top.
And we have five books in the shop.